Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we mark the annual celebration of Labor Day, and once again we've invited Matthew Dennis to share with us his thoughts on the history and meaning of this civic holiday. Dennis is the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar. After that, Kelly Shrum will introduce us to an online site where you can learn more about one particular area of labor, home labor, or more specifically, the rise of home economics. And finally, for our commentary of the week, Jenny Thompson will tell you what she has learned about the motives and performance of 20th century war reenactors, what they do, and why. But first, let's take a look at two items of historical interest in the news, one related to labor and the other to war. Perhaps it's appropriate for Talking History during the week of Labor Day to report that slave labor history is about to be revived at the hands of none other than a bipartisan congressional committee. Visitors 200 years ago wrote of the irony of slaves building the first American temples of freedom, the Capitol, and what was then called the President's House in Washington, D.C. They noted that in the construction of those buildings, which took place in the 1790s, slaves rented out by Maryland and Virginia farmers for $5 a month held many of the federal construction jobs. But that history had nearly died until leaders of the House and Senate approved a task force to recognize the slaves' roles. And the role slaves played in the construction was not limited to common labor. Indeed, reports suggest that some slaves worked as operators and managers of the quarry and a lumber mill that provided the main construction materials. One slave, Philip Reed, ran the foundry and managed the slaves who cast the 18-foot, 10-ton bronze monument atop the Capitol Dome. And a free black man from Baltimore, Benjamin Banneker, did much of the government surveying around the swampy farms that make up what is now downtown Washington. According to historian Ed Hodling, slave labor was not what then-President George Washington had in mind when planning for the Capitol's construction got underway in 1791. The government and its contractors initially sought white craftsmen, but the prevalence of slave labor in the area suppressed prevailing wages and made recruitment difficult. Thomas Jefferson, whom Washington named a commissioner in the city's construction, favored slave labor because it was cheaper, and he secured permission to hire up to 100 slaves a year. Hodling estimates that about 400 of the 650 workers on the Capitol's first two big projects were slaves. Now their story will be told. And the National Archives is releasing the military records of millions of enlisted men and women. The first batch, released in June, contained the service files for nearly 1.2 million soldiers, most of whom served between 1885 and 1939. Those records are among 56 million records stored at the Federal National Personnel Records Center just outside St. Louis. Under an agreement with the Pentagon, personnel files can be released to the archives 62 years after a service member leaves the military, but the records of persons of exceptional prominence can be released after only 10 years. Among those prominent people included in this initial release of military records are Joe Louis, Elvis Presley, Henry Fonda, Humphrey Bogart, Clark Gable, Charles Lindbergh, Franklin Roosevelt, John Kennedy, and Douglas MacArthur. When we return, Matthew Dennis and I will talk about the history of Labor Day. This is Talking History.
Give us a room with a view of the beautiful Rhine. Give us a room with a view of the beautiful Rhine. Give me a mighty old creek in Texas, any old time. I got those up, two, three, four, occupation GI blues. From my GI head to the heels of my GI shoes. And if I don't go stateside soon, I'm gonna blow my fuse.
With me this week for another in our year-long look at the history of the nation's major civic holidays is Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar. Some of you will recall our earlier conversations on Martin Luther King Day, President's Day, Memorial Day, and Independence Day. This week, we'll be discussing the origins and development of Labor Day. Welcome back, Matthew.
Good to be back.
When was the first public celebration of Labor Day?
Labor Day started officially on September 5th, 1882, in New York City, in a huge kind of labor festival and march through Lower Manhattan, and ultimately up to board a group of train cars and go off to celebrate a big picnic at the end. So 1882 is when it really starts.
What prompted it? What was it intended to celebrate?
It was really an expression of the need of working people in the late 19th century to organize themselves, to protect themselves, as they would say, against the exploitation of industrialist capitalists. It was a day to express their militancy, solidarity with other workers, show their strength, to show that they had a certain amount of rights and that they would defend them. And so it had a festive quality as well. And in a way, it was a one-day general strike. So it expressed the power of labor, of workers, to control their destiny, at least by walking off their jobs for one day and celebrating themselves.
Okay. Good start, but still a localized one. How long did it take for it to become a national holiday?
Well, it spread pretty quickly. The first Labor Day was organized by the Central Labor Union in the New York metropolitan area. It was an umbrella group of various other unions from various political stripes. New York at the time was holding a General Assembly of the Knights of Labor, another labor organization founded in 1869. And so it already incorporated people from various places, even beyond the metropolitan area of New York. Quickly it spread to other cities and other states, so that within 5 years, by 1887, Oregon became the first state to establish an official state Labor Day. That same year, five other states did the same. By 1894, 24 states had proclaimed state Labor Days, and it became a national holiday. So it's actually a fairly rapid event in terms of emerging on the American calendar.
Yeah, that is pretty quick. Internationally, Labor Day is on May Day. Why do we have a separate day in the United States for Labor Day in early September?
It's interesting. The May Day celebration of Labor Day actually comes from the United States. The first May Day was declared internationally by the Second International in 1890, and it was supposed to coincide with some strikes throughout the United States to win an 8-hour day. It was usually successful internationally. In the United States, Americans were already attached to this early September date. Increasingly, what we'd see is the two days kind of competing with each other. But May Day had a much more radical reputation, and it was resisted both by government officials and also by more conservative labor activists. In fact, one of the reasons why the early September Labor Day became ensconced in the American calendar is really to fight the emergence of the May Day Labor Day. So instead, we see on May Day increasingly holidays like Loyalty Day, which never really took, but it was a direct response to the more radical approach.
We don't have a lot of time to spend on history prior to the first Labor Day, but there is a history that leads up to this. Maybe you could just very briefly go over that for us.
Yeah, from the earliest days of the Republic, workers, artisans, and mechanics had organized themselves and tried to defend their interests. They participated in various kinds of festivals and parades, especially in urban areas in seaboard towns and cities. They were involved in some of the first 4th of July parades, and they marched in their orders by their trades. And often, initially, they would use the 4th of July as a day to try to agitate for their interests, for economic as well as political democracy. By the 1790s, we see the emergence of strikes by Philadelphia carpenters, for example, in 1791. And by the early 19th century, especially by the 1830s, the transformation in the economy, the growth of commerce, and especially industrial production had really changed the working lives of Americans. And many of them decided that what they really needed to do was band together, form unions, and they began to do that, sometimes using the 4th of July to demonstrate their interests, and in other cases, using general strikes, kind of proclaiming labor days as days off when they could make their political points. And that would continue through the 19th century up until the 1880s.
I thought one of the more interesting points that you made in your chapter here about Labor Day that ties us back in some ways to Martin Luther King Day is, and I'll quote you, "Activists walked a fine line between cultivating internal solidarity and militancy for their cause on the one hand, and on the other hand, developing legitimacy externally with a mass public and the state." And again, you made a similar point when you talked about King Day, the idea of what you call particularity and universalism, or celebrating one segment of the population but appealing to a larger American public. Why was this the case, and how did they handle it?
Well, it was a dilemma. You know, on the one hand, Labor Day is very much about working class culture and interests and the celebration of the kind of labor that built America. This is something, it's possible for all Americans and people worldwide to identify with the toil that they do every day. On the other hand, that universal message, if it becomes too universal, then, and we celebrate all labor, then ultimately it leeches away some of the particularity to the message. And so it loses its ability to make political points. And American history is filled with conflicts over labor and over the nature of production and wages and working conditions. So the question becomes, is Labor Day about unionized workers trying to build solidarity and protect their rights, or is it about just kind of generic labor? You know, again, the latter will help make it appealing to Americans more generally. The former might make it actually more effective. And so, in a sense, the key is to make any holiday immediately meaningful to a large segment of population without broadening the definition so much that it almost means nothing at all.
Okay, and we had a similar conversation way back when we did our first interview on Martin Luther King Day, so that's a good point. Does Labor Day, let's say, suffer a burden here because it isn't associated with a particular heroic figure like Washington or Lincoln?
Yeah, I think that most holidays achieve an identity when they're associated with some major event or some particular figure, whether it's George Washington, Martin Luther King, or the American Revolution, or the Civil War, or something like that. So it, in a way, it loses some focus. In some cases, we see labor leaders talking about this as an advantage, not tied to any particular person or event, in a sense making the day more democratic, more broadly appealing. But the fact of the matter is, constituencies are important in holidays, and in order to keep them vital, we need people pushing to keep them alive, to keep the meaning of them alive, so that they don't just become kind of generic days off, devoid of anything but leisure.
Okay. You just made a reference to the beginning and the end, and it's a general reference to what we now recognize as Memorial Day and Labor Day being bookends for summer, one starting summer, the other ending summer. But then you conclude your chapter on Labor Day with one of your, I think, more critical passages on American holidays, and I'll quote you here. You write, "Memorial Day and Labor Day stand as monuments to the success of the United States economy, and we treat these monuments as we treat most others. That is, we seldom pause to consider their prescribed meanings. With a focus on relatively mindless apolitical leisure, America's Labor Day is an appropriately ironic class holiday for America's supposedly classless society, and Memorial Day an appropriately ironic feast for people not known for their historical consciousness or memory." Talk about that for us.
Well, let me focus particularly on Labor Day here rather than Memorial Day,
sure.
But it does strike me as ironic that on Labor Day we do no labor. We don't remember working class contributions to the United States. We shop rather than we produce. We celebrate it as if there's no divisions in the country, socially or economically, as if class doesn't exist, even if we supposedly live in a classless society. It's a national holiday at a time when economic life is increasingly international, transnational, even global. You know, a time when jobs are lost abroad and the national policies don't necessarily seem particularly attuned to the plight of workers. So what seems to have happened is it really has become one of those St. Mondays, wholly because it's part of a three-day weekend rather than having any really clear meaning to most Americans. And so, again, that seems to me the height of irony. And in some ways, it was meant to be that way. it's a good thing to have three-day weekends. It's a good thing to have weekends all together, and that's one thing that the labor movement helped bring about. So why shouldn't workers be able to indulge in all sorts of leisure on Labor Day? You know, they've earned it. And that's one of the things that laborers struggled for so long to get, some time off, a working day that's manageable and so forth. So to that extent, it really does make sense. You know, as a historian, I wish we had a greater historical consciousness and mindfulness about the meanings behind some of these days. I think it would help us understand where we are based on where we've been.
Let me follow up on that a bit, because I think it's an interesting comment. When we talk about Labor Day and the things that it's supposed to mark, especially taking it back to where you started from in the first Labor Day in 1882, I think it would be very hard for most people, even though they perhaps have studied it in their history classes, to really grasp the history of American labor and what it is they would even be thinking about on Labor Day. And I think it's just one of the most difficult holidays for people to get their minds around. Would you agree or disagree with that?
You know, I guess I would agree. We all have to work to make ends meet, but in a certain sense, we don't really know what it was like to work in the past. You know, this is not always the case, surely, but today we live in a leisure society and we have a service economy, and so we do very different kinds of work, and our whole system is set up in ways that really focus on consumption and leisure, and we define ourselves through what we buy and what we do for fun more often than how we work, what we do in our working lives. So I think there's a real cultural transformation that's occurred, certainly, you know, in the 20th century, that makes it difficult for us to understand the working lives of Americans who lived in an earlier time, how hard they had it, how hard they had to work. And we take for granted many of the things that they had to fight so hard to gain.
Well, I think that's a good point, and I think that's what some of the value of your chapter, because you bring in references to the Haymarket Square bombing, which, again, is just not something that many people think about these days. When we think of violence, we don't think of labor carrying out violent acts, or incidents like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in Lower Manhattan. These are traumatic events that generally we just don't even think about these days.
No, I think you're right, and I think we're certainly attuned to violence in our society, threats of terrorism and so forth. You know, in the 19th century, many of the fears that people had were related to these battles between capital and labor, and in many cases, I think the imagined threats of labor and its agitation really called into play some incredible violence and repression that are not well known historically. I mean, they are to historians, but not more generally. And I think it would be useful to learn more about those things generally.
Well, I would agree, and I guess that's why your book is so important that we're spending the whole year on it. But so thank you for joining us, Matthew. Really appreciate it.
Great to be with you, Brian.
And for our listeners, you'll be coming back to talk about Columbus Day and Thanksgiving, the final two American holidays in our series. Thanks again, and I've been speaking with Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar. This is Talking History. Not all labor has taken place in the nation's factories. Some very important work has been done in the home, and that ought to be recognized this week as well. Toward that end, Talking History regular Kelly Shrum is here to tell you about a home economics archive containing books and journals documenting the rise of home economics from 1850 to 1925. Shrum is the assistant director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
An 1833 guide to the duties of children warns against the slippery slope of adolescent disobedience. This wicked girl was once a playful child, innocent and happy. At first she ventured to disobey in some trifling things. She went on from bad to worse. If you begin as she began, by trifling disobedience and little acts of unkindness, you may soon be as wicked as she, and make your parents as unhappy as is her poor, broken-hearted mother. This site offers books and journals related to the science of home economics. Its goal is to document the rise of home economics to a profession beginning in the middle of the 19th century, and to promote the study of home economics in the academic mainstream. Primarily focused on the years from 1850 through 1925, the site contains digitized texts of 934 books and 218 journal volumes, totaling almost 400,000 pages. Pages may be viewed as images or as text. Visitors may use the search engine, look through the subject index, or browse alphabetically by author, title, or year of publication. Subjects include childcare, clothing and textiles, housekeeping and etiquette, hygiene, and retail and consumer studies. Each subject entry includes a 500-word essay, two or three images, a detailed bibliography available as a PDF file, and a list of possible subtopics. This is an outstanding site full of primary sources and a great resource for researchers, students, and teachers. To locate this site, visit historymatters.gmu.edu and type home economics into the keyword search.
I just found a woman. She ain't nothing for looks. But out in the kitchen, she tends to business and cooks. Talking about soul food. Plenty of good soul food. It needs to hot poke, and that's home cooked for two.
Everything is tasty, I believe in letting you know. Not only anything, a little romance, that'll be all you need. You can cook it, take a chance.
Don't feed me whiskey, gin, and wine. Cook me dinner.
Cook and serve me something tasty to chew. And maybe I realize that all I'm really longing for is you. My, what a delicious looking pudding. Let me have a little bite. My, you really take care of business tonight. Really got the pots on this evening. What a meal, what a meal.
And finally, as promised, Jenny Thompson has done a study of some people you may well encounter in your travels this Labor Day week. Thompson is the author of War Games, Inside the World of 20th Century War Reenactors, in which she delves into what she describes as the subculture of war reenacting. Her commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network.
Like many Americans, 20th century war reenactors are captivated by war stories. Tales of average people who found themselves part of the world's most momentous event. Nearly all reenactors grew up reading about these experiences, watching war movies, and hearing tales told by their veteran relatives. Despite all the books and movies, however, their curiosity about war wasn't satisfied. Only through their private reenactments, they argue, can they come close to understanding war. A private reenactment can be astonishing indeed. Night battles in the trenches, eerie interrogations in the woods. These are the scenes in which reenactors strive to experience what they call a magic moment, a time when everything comes together and looks and feels authentic. But I found that reenacting is not an attempt to recreate the past and relive it. In fact, reenactors don't even reenact specific battles. Nor do they behave as if they were other people. Theirs is a rather generic rendition of war, in which they try to represent, in authentic detail, the typical experiences of common soldiers. We're not reliving the experience, as one reenactor explains. We're living it for ourselves. In seeking the ever-elusive magic moment, reenactors are not trying to time travel. Instead, they attempt to create their own authentic-looking illusions of history, but these are not replicas of the pure past. They are replicas of other representations of history. So rather than trying to recreate war itself, reenactors try to stage moments and scenes that duplicate elements from the films, photographs, and stories which they judge to be authentic representations of war. But this time, it is the reenactors who are in the center of these representations. This is history in action. It's an attempt to produce and consume history simultaneously. And reenactors revel in their power to create their own historical evidence, films and photographs that feature themselves at war. In doing so, they exercise a kind of power over representing history that isn't available to them otherwise. It is this very power to represent history, and thereby claim a kind of ownership over it, that enthralls reenactors. Raised in a culture replete with war stories, they can now put on the boots of the common soldiers and walk around in them for themselves. They can tell their own war stories. The desire to be part of the long history of war representations lies at the heart of reenacting. In understanding this desire and the various and dramatic ways it plays itself out in reenacting, we can glimpse something of war's powerful and enduring impact on American culture.
You've been listening to Jenny Thompson, the author of War Games: Inside the World of 20th Century War Reenactors, published by Smithsonian Books. This is Talking History. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer. Alex Smith is our studio engineer. To learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu. Or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.